We all have all of those core story patterns, which is why, of course, they kicked you in the gut, is because they're all so relatable. And yet, most of us have what I perceive is a primary story pattern and a couple secondary story patterns that we walk through for our entire life.
Welcome back to another episode of Going There with Life Coach Jen Vertanen. Going There is a show where no topic is off limits and no story too much. Each week features real, honest, unfiltered, and oftentimes hilarious conversations about all the things that make us, break us, and shape us, shared in the spirit that healing is possible. Side note, this is an adult show with adult language about adult topics, probably not the best to play in front of the kiddos. And where possible, I will provide content warnings in case a topic is especially sticky for you and you'd rather avoid. For more information, head over to goingtherewithjen.com. And now on to the show. All right. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Going There. As always, I have an absolutely fascinating guest today. And I think she actually might be one of the most fascinating because, well, I'll let her tell you about all the things that she has her fingers in, all the work that she does, and especially how it all comes together. So welcome, Susan Chiara.
Hi, Jen. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So happy to have you here. So as we talked about, I'd really love to hear you introduce yourself from your perspective, because from my perspective, again, there's all these things that you do and they're all incredibly cool and seem very separate from each other, but I know that they all inform each other. So I'd love to hear it from your own voice, your own words.
Well, thank you. What's fun is, of course, my impulse now is to ask you first what you think I do.
And then, I mean, we can start there. We can go there.
No, that's all right. I won't put you on the spot for that. So I'm a holistic wellness educator and facilitator. I'm also a writer and speaker and performer. So right away, those things can sound very much like a lot of different things. But really, I use all of those things for one thing, which is that my work centers around helping people identify and unwind the limiting beliefs or the limiting stories, our core stories that keep us stuck. So I use a variety of experiential modalities to help people unwind those stories. So basically, the work centers around the limiting beliefs or the core stories, and then the variety, the education, the facilitation, the writing, the speaking, the performing, those are what I would say are the tools that I use to help individuals, couples, businesses, and communities understand and clear those stories that keep them stuck. So I use a variety of different experiential modalities. I use breath work, space work. I am a mediator, credentialed mediator and conflict coach. So that's the work that I use with couples and with organizations and communities. I do something called constellation work, which is targeted around generational trauma and stories. So it's a number of different experiential pieces that, again, all center around this idea of story.
Yeah. So I know you do cabaret as one of those modalities. And I'm just curious how that, you talk about the one thing, which is really to unstick our stories and identify our core beliefs, right? And I'm curious how cabaret can play into that.
Oh, that's a fun question. So I wish I could say that I did cabaret on a really regular basis. Theater is, let me back up and say, my original training is as a performer. So I actually have my BFA in theater. And that is a double emphasis in design and performance. So that design piece is what ended up being the training for some of the work that I do with space. And the theater training is obviously influenced, certainly in addition to the performing, it influences the writing, the speaking, and the piece about people's stories, because of course, theater is centered around people's stories. And it also is about the psychology, because I started in college as a communications major with a psych minor. And at that point, I thought I was going to be a speaker. That was my goal. I was going to be a professional speaker. I have no idea what I thought I was going to be speaking about, because it's not like I really had a platform at that point. But that's such a testament, I think, to how as a soul, we kind of know our path, whether or not we know all the dots and how we're going to get there. So I ended up transferring from being a communications major and psych minor to the theater department and getting my BFA. But obviously, psychology plays a big role in theater and performance and really understanding characters and the stories that we as humans carry with us. So flash forward, over the years, theater got set aside and I became a holistic wellness practitioner. That was born out of, most people understand, of course, that being in the arts, most of us have a secondary career path. And so at a certain point in my 20s, I still loved doing theater, but I decided I wanted to do something else that I loved just as much. I, at that point, was doing the temping thing where you are performing in the evening, sometimes during the day, if you were lucky enough to get those gigs, and also temping. And I thought, okay, there's something more that I want to do. And that's when I started pursuing holistic wellness, which was almost 20 years ago now.
Wow. You're almost a pioneer in that space then.
A little bit, which is weird to say, actually, but certainly things have changed in that time period since I began. So I would say that is a little bit of the case. So I guess this is a long way of saying that when I decided to pursue holistic wellness, I never intended on theater taking a backseat. I always just assumed that they would be both of my career paths, but eventually holistic wellness raised its hand higher, we could say. And theater has been pretty much on the back burner for the last couple decades. But every now and again, it'll creep up as the thing that raises its hand and says, my turn, my turn. And so a few years ago, I did my last cabaret show where, as you said, it did very much tie into this work because it was actually a piece on identity. So I did a set around cultural identity, and then I invited three other performers who did sets around, one was around racial identity, one was around sexual identity, there was another one around cultural identity. So it was a fun opportunity to be able to connect the dots between all of this work that I do with people's stories and, of course, putting it on the stage in a delightful way. There was music and story and fun stuff there. So that's how it connects.
That's how it connects. So I'm curious, as you're talking about the different modalities, are there a couple that are your favorite? Or is it, as you said, kind of one raising its hand like the cabaret and saying, oh, hey, it's my turn. It's been a while.
Well, when I first started officially doing holistic wellness professionally, so that was about 18 years ago, I started doing space work. And so what that means, because I simply call it space work now, is that I became certified in classical feng shui. And that was very early into the feng shui movement in terms of the Midwest. So certainly on the West Coast and the East Coast, feng shui was already a thing, but it was still pretty new here in the Midwest. So people didn't really know what it was. And very much just a real level of misunderstanding, which of course, some of it was cultural misunderstanding. There's a lot that we don't understand from a cultural perspective, but also just a philosophical perspective of what feng shui really was. So I had that background in classical feng shui. I had my design background from college, that BFA in design. And then I learned pretty quickly that my intuitive side was really very highly attuned in physical environments. So what would happen is I would go into people's physical environments and I could pretty immediately recognize what was happening for them in their life. It was not about the space. And it became very clear to me very early on that it was not about the space. So it began to really morph into recognizing that this was about people's commitment issues, people's overwhelm, lots of trauma, though I didn't use that word at the time. And it's also important to note that I was not working with people who were, you know, we use the term hoarding now. And I think people assume, oh, if you were working with space, you must have been working with people that, and just as a sidebar, hoarding as itself is a trauma response, which we understand a lot more now. But no, most of my clients were actually just your average person with maybe some extra clutter, but not really anything that we would consider a real issue or problematic. Mostly people who were curious, who were interested in how their space might be reflecting something about their life, and that's how the space work started. And the reason why I'm saying all of this is because for a long time, space work was really how most people knew me. That was more like my, what I would say, my public persona. I got the name the Space Guru before everybody was using the word guru, and it was very, it's very overused at this point, but it was actually a nod to my yogic philosophy. Yoga is, as a philosophy, not as a physical practice, is very big for me. And so my yogic philosophy was influencing the work that I did with space. So the Space Guru was actually a nod to me as a teacher and a bringer of light to these shadowy spaces that live in our unconscious and manifest in our physical environments. And so the space work is where it all began. And so in a way, that's the thing that was raising its hand for a while. I realized that very quickly I was working at a deeper level than just the physical environment. And right away, as I said, I was starting to feel like, do you have stomach issues? And what's happening with your husband? And all of these things where I was like, ooh, this might not just be about space. So I started actually learning more about energy work, and I started to do body work and was working with people one-on-one through body work and energy work. And that led me to pursue my training in something called rebirthing breath work, which is a somatic modality that helps people unwind trauma through the breath. And I've been doing that work for 15 years.
Wow. Again, you're a pioneer in that work, it sounds like.
A little bit. It's hard to say that, because I think about my teacher, Leonard Orr, who just passed last year, and talk about pioneer, because, you know, he was bringing this work to the West in the beginning of the 70s, because really it's all based on pranayama or yogic breath work. But of course, yes, it's become a big trendy thing now.
And
definitely you hear a lot more about it. And again, usually on the coasts, because they get it. They get it before it trickles over into the Midwest here. But yeah, so I've been doing breath work for 15 years. And when I started doing that, it had such a deep impact on people that right away that became the thing that raised its hand. So space work remained a big part of my work and my brand. As I said, it kind of stayed my public brand, even though I was actually doing a lot more breath work than I was doing space work. And that was simply because people were really finding their way to me with this work. One of the things that I'm sure you know, because I know you interview a lot of people about trauma, and that's something that's close to your own heart, is that trauma lives so much in the body that we can only access it so much through talk therapy and those kinds of cognitive modalities, that having something that was a somatic or body-based modality like breath work, people were seeing really amazing results really efficiently. So people who had been seeing a therapist for years would come to me, and in a couple months, they would start to see changes that they had not seen in years. Now, I'm a firm advocate of talk therapy, and I actually highly recommend that. But for some people, it's definitely not the way or the only way, and they really do need something that is more body-based to access some of those deeper traumas. So breath work became, as I said, the thing that kept its hand up. And that has been the primary way that I earn a living for most of the last 15 years. So even though I was doing the other modality of space work and some other modalities have come in since, that was pretty much the main bread and butter for my business until COVID-19 hit. And a breathwork, as one can imagine, is a very intimate act.
Yeah.
There is a lot of, you know, oxygen exchange happening. And fortunately for me, I had the insight, I guess this is the benefit of being an intuitive, right? Is I had the insight to start doing some other kinds of training over the years. So a number of years ago, I think probably about 8 years ago, I did my first training in mediation. And it's a specific kind called transformative mediation. And that is something that then a couple years ago, I became a credentialed mediator, or what's called a qualified neutral.
Ooh, fancy.
Formal fancy name for saying that I can help people legally facilitate conflict. So what's been cool about that is that that's been a wonderful addition to my work, to helping specifically couples and larger groups navigate conflict. And that's something that can easily be done remotely. Mm-hmm. There's no breath exchange happening there. So the good news is that also is part of my breath work that I do. I work so heavily with people's stories, and I've developed my own process that I simply call story work that can also be done remotely, separate from the breath work. So I've been really fortunate in being able to transition my business into focusing really on the story work sessions and those couples work sessions, as I call them, that pull on both the story work and the mediation skills that I have. And I've been doing a lot of online teaching as well. So I guess I have very long answers for you, which is
No, it's all incredibly interesting. And the question that comes up for me, because obviously I like stories. That's why I have my podcast, right? I want to give a way for people to share their stories, because I believe that when we share them, we feel less alone and we help others feel less alone, right? And I'm wondering, in the work that you do, are there common themes that come out with people's stories, or are they each relatively unique?
So many common themes.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that one of the most common themes is thinking that we are alone in our story.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that there are common themes, of course, does not dismiss that we are all very unique individuals, and everything that we experience is unique to us. In fact, a big part of my work with core stories is I've developed something that I call the core story patterns. And the core story patterns are a simple system that I've created to help people understand the 7 main themes where we get stuck or hooked or triggered or whatever words we want to use around them. And they are, as I see them, worth, lovability, belonging, safety, competency, power, and freedom.
Mm-hmm. Each of those kind of kicked me in the gut. Not in a bad way.
I know, but
it's a visceral, like, you know what each of those means, right? And how they show up in your life.
Absolutely. And the way I explain it is that we all have all of those core story patterns, which is why, of course, they kicked you in the gut, is because they're all so relatable. And yet, most of us have what I perceive is a primary story pattern and a couple secondary story patterns that we walk through for our entire life. And I would say that the other story patterns tend to show up based on circumstances, time periods, what's happening in the collective, any of those kinds of things might influence how these story patterns come up and then go back down. But we as individuals are seeing our whole life through that particular lens. So when I talk about core story, and I define, in case it's not clear to anybody listening, I define a core belief, and this is not just my definition. This is, I didn't create core beliefs, obviously, but core beliefs are any belief that we have about ourself, other people, or the world around us. And these beliefs form when we are very, very young. They're usually set in place by the age of 5. I describe 4 main ways that I perceive that they come into our life. We can talk about that if you want. But basically, I call them our subconscious operating system. So mm-hmm. they're basically what is running the show behind the scenes. And those story patterns are the primary pattern of our individual operating system. And so when you ask, do we have as individuals common, you know, themes or common stories, I would say yes. Those 7 are, I've just actually developed that core story pattern framework in the last year formally, even though I've been informally working mm-hmm. with it for a number of years. I finally named it something and really have fleshed it out more. And so it's been informed by this 18 years of work and seeing that these are definitely the patterns that I personally see the most. It's not to say that there are not other patterns. They're, sure. they're just ones that I perceive. And it's fascinating because the gift of identifying them is once you have a framework, you can see your life through that framework in a much more compassionate, non-judgmental way. Mm-hmm. I myself, for example, was really recognizing just yesterday, wow, I'm really working with some belonging stuff right now. And so just like anything, whether we're talking about astrology or the Enneagram or the love languages or strength finders or any of these other frameworks that exist out in the world, it depersonalizes it in a way that helps us say, ah, I see myself in that. And that doesn't mean I'm a bad person or I'm wrong or shame on me. It's just, ooh, really got some worth stuff happening right now. Oh, wow. Competency is really triggering me right now. And I think it's a really healthy and safe way for us to explore what's happening without having a lot or at least less judgment.
Yeah. On right. Ourselves. Yeah. Yeah. That's very similar to the work I do with clients, but I haven't developed my framework yet. So it's neat to hear you talk about that for sure. So what we haven't touched, well, we touched on a little bit is the trauma piece. And you even talk on your website about helping others with childhood trauma. So I'm going to set that aside for now. What we haven't touched on yet, which is incredibly relevant, is the anti-racism work that you're also involved in right now. And you actually have a pledge on your website and an active Facebook group specifically around that. So I'm curious how that came about and how your work is informing that work.
Yes. So the first thing I'm going to say is I am definitely not an anti-racism educator. That's not the angle through which I have decided to facilitate this work. What I am is a trauma educator, mm-hmm. and racism is one of the largest, if not the largest, collective and historical traumas. I say historical because, of course, it goes back so long, and collective because it has not been resolved. So unlike some historical traumas that perhaps we can speak of in a past tense, racism is obviously, unfortunately, alive and well. And since it is such a major trauma, I saw it as something that overlaps with my work very significantly. So over the years, I've definitely worked with individual clients addressing racism as a trauma that it has existed for their personal experience, but I've never done anything that was a larger, more public program or anything of that sort around racism or anything taking an anti-racist approach. So this was born out of when George Floyd was killed, which was 10 blocks from my own home. It was born out of this call that I was seeing from a lot of people in my community of wanting to actively work towards dismantling racism within themselves and within their communities, and perhaps not really knowing what steps to take. It was also something that I was seeing from some of my Black friends saying, yes, white people, I see that you are interested in this. And also, I kind of don't believe you, meaning I don't know that you're still going to be here doing this work in a month or in a year or in 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so taking in all of that input, I thought, okay, what's needed here? And then I was speaking to one of my friends who is actually a diversity, equity, inclusion coach. And he invited me into, I was doing a lot of writing on the subject on social media. And he invited me into beyond my writing, seeing if I felt inspired to invite people to do something specific. And from him just saying that very loosely, this three-part pledge was born into my consciousness. Just one night, I was like, it's a three-part pledge, and it focuses on educate, communicate, activate. And so basically what I'm doing is I'm using my skill set, which is to create simple, effective systems to help people change neural pathways in their brain, in other words, so that they will have actions reinforced and have a new way of walking in the world. I'm using that skill set that I have and my understanding of how that intersects with trauma to create this pledge that focuses around helping people in a really tangible way recognize that there's three parts. We need to learn about things so that our actions are actually informed and not just. So often, I'm going to back up and say, like, even in physical environments in space, I facilitated something called the Fabulous Paper Purge for 5 years. And people want to dive in right away and start going through their paperwork and just getting rid of stuff. And I'm like, oh, slow down, slow down, slow down. We don't want to just go into the action. We really need to reflect first and understand why we're keeping the paper, why there's these psychological traps we get hooked into, all of that. So my work is very action-based, but it's always about informed action. So the same holds true with when we are actively seeking to dismantle racism, because otherwise, especially as white people, we can very much land into white saviorship and just be like, I will help you. But if that is not actually informed, especially by the Black community, then what are we doing and why? Is it for us?
Right.
Or is it for other people? So the education piece of this pledge is reminding us to slow down and get informed. The communication part of this pledge taps into, of course, my training as a mediator and conflict coach to help people have hard conversations with themselves, first and foremost, and with each other. Because I don't think that most of this work is about just changing people's minds. I think the most impactful part of this work is about changing policy. And yet, of course, there is an interconnection piece. We can't really change policy without also changing the collective consciousness. So it's a two-part dance. Well, there's probably more parts, many more parts to the dance than that. But so the communication piece was big for me. And then finally, the activate is about taking active steps. So really aligning our actions with the information that we've learned and the conversations that we're having to really understand what action steps are really needed in order for us to see real change. So with this pledge, I invited a panel of three Black voices that could share their wisdom with this Facebook community to help us all learn and be informed by people other than my own voice as the facilitator and educator of the pledge. So I was really excited to be able to offer this to my community because, as I said, it was a way for me to tap into my skill sets, creating simple systems to change people's minds and create long-term action, and also learn myself and bring community together. And also, as I said, this pledge is designed so that you do these three steps and then you rinse, repeat, because it's really just about practice. And it's simple enough to make you understand this is like a long-term thing here. This isn't 1 month. No, right. This isn't 1 year. Yeah. You know, this is again, long-term.
Going back to what our Black friends say is that great that you're here now. Will you be here in a month? Will you be here in 3 years? Right. And I love that what you said about the rinse repeatness of it. It's not a one and done. It's never a one and done. And especially as we know, that's not how policy changes. We all need to be rinse repeating this. And I love that you've given a simple framework to step people through that. And I think that as much as I don't know how to say this, so if I say it wrong, please forgive me, listener, Susan, what have you. There's something about having a white person guide this that makes it a little bit easier for those of us that aren't as informed, aren't as educated, but want to do the work, right? Are waking up and saying, I want to do the work. And this to me is a great place to start. And I love that you've brought in Black panelists to inform that conversation. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I'm glad you mentioned it because what adds an extra layer to this is that I am indeed white, and white in terms of I identify as white. I am legally, as far as the census goes, considered white, but I'm actually first generation American and my parents are Middle Eastern. So I'm a Lebanese Egyptian with just a little splash of British.
I didn't know this about you.
That explains the formal piece.
Yeah,
so I joke about like, I'm very expressive. And then I've got this very formal, like, you know, take my hummus in a teacup sort of.
Oh my gosh. I love that. Hummus in a teacup. Okay. I'm getting a real picture of Susan now.
So my mom is very, very, very pale, very white. My dad has brown skin. And so I actually, now, of course, growing up, because my parents have been here over 50 years, we didn't call my dad brown growing up. That wasn't a thing. That wasn't a label that mm-hmm. we used. So I was born and raised in Minnesota. I've always thought of myself as white, as I've always identified as white. And people of Middle Eastern origin, as I said, are legally considered white according to the census. Mm. And some interesting conversation mm-hmm. about that over the years. But regardless, that's where it all lands. Although as one of my panelists reminds me, that may be the case, but you're still 25% African.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, that's odd, isn't it? I mean, in the sense of that you don't look at me and necessarily guess that or assume that or whatever it might be. And Egypt is a lot of people don't even consider Egypt in Africa.
Right, right.
Associated with, it's the Middle East, of course. It is indeed in Africa. So I offer all of that because there is this piece here where I recognize that I serve as a type of a bridge. And what I mean by that, of course, is that while I identify as white, I have a unique perspective of recognizing that even I, as a white person with immigrant parents and a brown-skinned father, can recognize my role in racism.
Right.
I can recognize my own racist beliefs and the way that I benefit from a white supremacist system. And I feel like if I can recognize that, even as somebody who has had prejudice in my own family and my own experiences of seeking to perhaps over-identify with white identity for my own security and sense of safety, that if I can acknowledge it, then surely other white people who have even whiter roots, perhaps we could say, can also see their role in this. That's my hope. You know, I, in my cabaret show 3 years ago, it's important for me to say that for a long time, I never spoke about cultural identity. And part of that, speaking of trauma, has a lot to do with my own sense of feeling safe in the world and feeling a sense of security and safety and belonging. Talk about going back to those core patterns with fitting in, not rocking the boat, not anything that might be perceived as different. And so I didn't speak about cultural stuff at all. It wasn't part of my work. It wasn't really a conversation I had publicly. Of course, I've never hidden my cultural identity because I still grew up in Minnesota. So most of my friends are like blonde and blue eyes. Right. So even though I have very pale skin, I still have very dark hair and eyes for Minnesotans. So people would assume, though, a lot of times that I was Italian or Spanish or something. So I'm very much like, my acting agent called me global for a long time. That was the language that was used before they identified me as, you know, Middle Eastern. I would often use the word Mediterranean.
Sure, sure.
Broader and more, less triggering to people. And so I wasn't hiding it by any means. I don't think I could hide that I obviously look some level of ethnic, but I certainly wasn't making it part of my work or part of my platform or anything like that. And 3 years ago during the cabaret show, it was right after the election that I started writing this. And I recognized that even though probably more than ever, it was even scarier to talk in a really open way about anything that distinguishes me as different in any kind of cultural sense, that I could no longer stay silent. That I felt like I had to use my, what did I call it? My Minnesotan spiritual, but not religious privilege to be a voice, a bridge to, you know, to talk about topics that were maybe hard for other people or things that other people didn't feel safe to talk about. And because representation is so important, otherwise people have this very one idea of what it means to be a Middle Eastern woman or something, you know, and they don't recognize like, oh, very much like the same conversation I'm seeing my Black friends having right now in terms of, we are not a monolith. It's not all one thing. You know, this idea of, I don't know if you know Ibram X. Kendi. He's a
I'm attending his workshop on Monday, I believe.
Wonderful. Yes, wonderful. And he talks a lot about this idea of individualism and how as white people, we get to not be defined by the actions of random white people.
Right.
Whereas others, meaning Black individuals, Middle Eastern individuals, Indigenous individuals, a lot of individuals, in fact, depending on the group, get very much identified through the lens of a group, you know? And again, it becomes very much like you are judged by the actions of the most shadowy behaviors of your group.
I never thought about it that way, but you're absolutely, interesting. I'm excited for that workshop. And I know I had posted it on Facebook and a number of my friends are also attending. I think I'm going to post it again, see if tickets are still available.
And to go back to your question about, does it make it more accessible to have a white person being a bridge for white people in these conversations? I think, unfortunately, it does for some people. Yeah. And the thing is there's a lot of Robin Angelo's work with
white fragility.
White fragility has obviously taken off. There are a lot of Black educators that have really requested that people support Black voices, you know, in a versus white educators. And I do believe that there is an importance for various voices in the conversation, but I agree that the white voices should not be the loudest voices.
They shouldn't be number one in the bestseller list for anti-racism work.
Right. And I think that's really what the big you know, pushback with that is. And, you know, and if I didn't see other Black educators that I respect also holding up Robin's work as important work, then, you know, maybe I would feel differently about it. But I do understand that viewpoint. And I think that's really important. And I wish it wasn't the case that we needed these bridges, you know, but some people do, and it is really unfortunate. And yet I think probably true in most conversations about like different kinds of viewpoints, or, you know, I think sometimes we need somebody, like I think about how we need maybe somebody else who was in the military, who has had a shift in perception, to talk to other people who were in the military about the maybe challenges or shadowy parts of that or whatever. We need somebody who was a police officer to speak to other police officers. We need some way in which we can identify with somebody. And that's just, it's actually just a natural part of how we trust humans, whether or not we are conscious of it or not.
Yeah, that's where it was hard and uncomfortable for me to ask that, but there's that nugget of truth in there, right? That we need these bridges. And so I'd rather have the bridges exist than not exist. And we're all just faltering and not doing the work.
But that's why it was, as you said, very important for me to invite my friends, the panelists, into the conversation. Because, as I said, I very much was mindful that I am the facilitator.
Yes, not the educator.
You know, and I'm the educator through the lens of the trauma piece, but not through the racial piece.
Right. Important distinction there.
Yeah. And that it's kind of like, it's a little bit like knowing your place and staying in your lane.
Yeah. While still moving the conversation forward.
Exactly.
Yeah. Amen. So with that, we've been talking a lot, and I know we wanted to talk about both your professional and the personal, but I'm wondering, do you have time to go into the personal a little bit?
Yeah. Well, and I feel like I just did.
Yeah. Yeah,
because for me, I admit that even talking about the cultural stuff for me is very personal. In some ways, it's oddly more personal than probably what other people perceive, like, oh, you know, I had this childhood thing or this divorce that I had or this other, you know, very personal, juicy, whatever thing that happened in my, you know, it's like, meh, you know, because to me, those things in some way hit me in a much less, ooh, that's a little scary to talk about way. The cultural piece is actually ironically still a piece for me that I'm dipping my toe into the water and going, is this okay? Can I talk about this? Can I talk about this publicly? And what it speaks to is how much trauma actually exists around it.
Yeah.
Whether I want to admit that or not.
Right. I'm wondering for you, which of the core story themes does that roll up into? Or does it touch upon a few of them?
It's the primary one, and I spoke to this in my cabaret show, is actually about safety.
Interesting.
And I thought it was also about belonging. And I would say that it flip-flops back and forth between those two things. And I don't know that I can choose which one it is more when it comes to this. It feels like there is both a safety and belonging piece. Now, I want to speak to what safety means, because safety doesn't just mean for any of us. When safety is a core story pattern, we're not just talking about physical safety here. We're talking about spiritual safety, emotional safety, the safety to speak up and have our voice be heard without fear of consequence, whatever that means. So for some people, that really is rooted in physical safety. For other people, it's emotional safety, meaning I will be I will be abandoned if I share my opinion with my family or my friends or something of that sort. And there's an emotional safety piece there. Spiritual just means that even deeper layer of stuff where it's not just maybe something we think or feel, but it's something that we know we embody. And do we feel safe in terms of, can we truly be ourselves and all that comes with it and still be loved and accepted and belong and like all of the other story patterns, because there's an overlap and layer. So I would say for me that there is this sort of flip-floppy that happens. Mm-hmm. And I think that the belonging piece probably actually came first.
Yeah.
But the safety piece came in because there were things that triggered a sense of safety for me, even at a young age. My dad experienced prejudice. It impacted his work situation. My dad's highly educated. He has a PhD, which also contributed to making it harder to find a job at your level when you're also experiencing some layers of prejudice in that. And so at a young age, it impacted the stability, both emotionally and financially within the family. And so I think at a young age, I had an identification with being different is going to impact my safety and survival.
Right, right. Is that something that you actively work on, or is it just I have awareness and as I feel things bubbling up, I can now put that lens of the core belief pattern on top of that to help get curious about it, dissect it, figure out what I want to do in the moment with that feeling?
I think it's both. I think that there has been a sense of understanding it for a long time, but I think that it was like most people and their trauma. I think it was very highly suppressed. I wouldn't say it was repressed, meaning it was, I'm sure you know the difference in the definitions, but repression is, of course, when we have lost any kind of conscious awareness of the thing that we've experienced. And suppression is that there's an awareness, but there is minimizing perhaps that we do with it, or oh, mm-hmm. yeah, that thing happened, but whatever.
Whatever.
I'm over that.
Yeah.
I'm over that. Yeah. That doesn't really bother me, or whatever
yeah. it is. I was five. Yeah, that's so long ago.
Exactly. So that's the suppression. And the fact of the matter is that I think that I very much suppressed that this was a piece of my trauma story, if we want to call it that. I think we all have a trauma story, whether we call it that or not. I think I felt like I had enough other, you know, things happen in my life that felt more significant to me. You know, for a long time, I felt like I was processing a divorce, and then I was in a car accident, and I have PTSD from that car accident. So I hold, you know, physiological trauma in my body, and that would be so much easier to point to and be like, that's the thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But the reality is that this is the thing that I think has been hanging out in my consciousness since I was very young. And when I look back and recognize that this is actually a generational pattern, because I learned things about the, you know, I said that I have some British in me. You got to wonder, well, how did that British come into
get in there?
How did I get in there, right? It's because historically in my ancestral lineage, there is a story where somebody, a family member, comes to a different country and then is the outsider. And that is a pattern that has happened in both sides of my lineage. And then my parents coming to this country mm-hmm. and being immigrants and being like the outsider. Growing up, I don't think I was conscious of that at all, especially as I said, I was born and raised in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And with the exception of we lived in California for a few years, Minnesota was just like, this is just where I was. So something I learned through writing my cabaret show was that there were all of these things that I perceived as just personality things that I recognize retrospectively were cultural things. And when people would say things like, oh, you're so dramatic, or you're so emotional, or you're so big, you know,
mm-hmm. But now, you're a teeny tiny thing, but you have a big personality.
Right. is they definitely meant personality and emotion and expression. Mm-hmm. And let's not forget that I was a theater major. So,
there's that.
Yeah. Whatever I was harnessing from my natural genetics also got amplified into my career. But even as a performer, I was considered very over the top. Well, some of that I just chalked up to, oh, it's my personality, and people are interacting with or even being critical of my personality. Retrospectively, I'm like, I was not Minnesotan in my blood.
Right.
So I have always been more expressive, and I've always been more direct, and all of these things that Minnesotans are not. And mostly that's meant that people think that I'm a New Yorker. They're like, you're from the East Coast, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not, but my blood runs hot. And so there were a lot of things that, as I said, I think were just suppressed because they were just, my family did such a good job of assimilating. You know, my family mm-hmm. was very quick to assimilate. You know, they learned the language right away. I don't speak a second language, which is really kind of sinful, but there you go. When you have a family that assimilates very strongly, that's actually what happens. You lose the
culture. You lose it.
And so as a result of that, I think all of this awareness that we're talking about it being like a trauma or a lack of belonging or whatever, I think was very suppressed. And whatever was felt through the lens of it being very just a personal experience and not rooted in, oh, wait, maybe I didn't totally fit in because there were some cultural things
happening. Right. Interesting.
It wasn't even a conversation back then. I mean, you remember, we're around the same, generation. It's not like we were talking about this stuff back
not
then.
Not at all.
And in fact, there is a new layer that is happening with, as we start to talk about racism in a more active way, I think maybe ever have. There's also an awareness for myself of all of these things that I experienced as, I didn't know the word microaggression until five, six, 7 years ago, whatever that was. So the conversation around race has helped me recognize some things around prejudice that I certainly didn't know. And I didn't know I was experiencing, and recognizing it doesn't, just for the record, doesn't make me feel like more of a victim or anything of that sort. It actually just makes me feel like I have language to explain some of these past situations mm-hmm. that happened that I didn't understand the context for. It's an exploration. And really, I just use this as the example because we could be talking about anything here. We can remove it as a, I chose to talk about the cultural trauma piece because, first of all, it's, I think, an important conversation to be having right now. Second of all, it's up in my own work, mm-hmm. meaning, sure, I could tell you about other things that I experienced, but the fact is that I've already really integrated a lot of the other experiences I've had in my life. And even though I still experience PTSD from the car accident, for example, in terms of how it manifests when I'm driving on the freeway, that's not really something where I'm walking around on a day-to-day basis, like feeling the experiences of, driving.
Right.
Whereas this is something that, especially since this conversation has become more collective, I'm looking at it like, oh, this is probably important work for me.
Yeah. Too.
And it's my personal work preceded the death of George Floyd, meaning that I had already, ironically, I was looking up things like racial classifications and things, trying to kind of understand how did we begin to classify race in mm-hmm. this country specifically. Historically, I wanted to understand why Lebanese people became white, even though many, many Lebanese people are very white. As I said, my mom's full Lebanese. She's very white, but some Lebanese people are very brown skin, you know, and my dad's half Egyptian. So that's where on his side, the darker skin comes from the Egyptian side. And even so, Egyptians are considered white. And I wanted to understand historically what were the roots of that, only to find, of course, that racial classifications are all political.
Surprise, sure, surprise. Sure. Yeah.
You know, race, of course, is all made up, which, you know, Jane Elliott, do you know her?
I don't.
Oh, she is wonderful, Jen. She is this, speaking of white educators, she's an elder at this stage, but she developed this brown eye, blue eye experiment.
Oh, yeah. I know exactly. Yep.
I was going to say, sometimes people know the name of the experiment more than her name. And she talks a lot about race in terms of it being this made up construct and how it basically was just something where, you know, our ancestors moved further away from the equator and then, you know, our bodies adapted. And it's fascinating stuff when you realize, oh, wow, yeah, we've all been brainwashed into trading our culture for race.
Yeah.
So as each generation of our ancestors, including your own, I don't know how long your people have been here, but the fact of the matter is that your people and my people had a culture and have a culture that they traded for the privilege of whiteness.
Oh, that makes me so sad.
It is very sad. And in fact, one of the reasons why we hold on to our whiteness so much, besides, of course, our privilege, even though I know that's a very triggering word for many of us, is that we have lost that connection to our cultural identity. And in some ways, we get very triggered by people who haven't.
Yeah, right. Right.
And we're like, you need to assimilate too, is really what it is.
Yeah.
My people had to assimilate. You.
So you have to too.
And what it should actually be, and I hope this is what we're moving towards, is can we all reclaim these parts of our identity that we lost or were erased or were forced upon us to erase for political reasons, social and political reasons.
Yeah.
And what would that mean to reclaim that part of our story?
Yeah. Yeah. I look at other cultures that do have such a strong cultural presence. And I feel jealousy is the word that comes up, but not in a bad way, just in a sadness that I don't feel like I have that. But I recently learned that I'm 20% Norwegian Viking blood. So I'm like, ooh, that's kind of cool. I might play around with that a little bit and see. But I was raised being told I was 98% Welsh. So I was raised in some of the Welsh traditions in a small farming community down in Wisconsin that was settled by Welsh settlers. And so I had some of those traditions, but they didn't carry into adulthood. And so I very much feel that, what is my culture anyway, right? And now we have to create that. It almost feels like starting from scratch. And again, it brings me sadness. Again, jealousy isn't the right word, but I'm not sure what that word is. Yeah, grief. Yeah.
It's grief. It's grief. It's
loss. Loss of a culture that was once there.
Exactly. And here's the thing, and talk about trauma, is when we lose a piece of our identity, it doesn't matter what part of our identity, this is that soul loss. Mm-hmm. We will carry the pain of that, whether conscious or unconscious. Mm-hmm. And you and I both know that line, hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that pain that we carry is the source of so much of our hatred toward other.
Someone who's other.
Because we have lost a part of ourself. And when we are not even connected with ourself, how can we truly connect with someone else? I mean, we can fake it.
Yeah.
And we can have layers. I'm not saying
absolutely, absolutely.
You know, I always say that healing is not something like you have to heal first, then you function in the world. Obviously, it's something that we're doing concurrently.
Right, right. And we're always finding new layers. Right. So with that, as we wrap up, I would, again, we'll have all of your information in the show notes, including where the pledge is in the Facebook group. But I'm curious what you're looking forward to. And I'm curious if there's any resources besides your body of work that you can recommend to the listeners. Let's start with what you're excited about.
What I am excited about is the fact that we are collectively having very hard conversations. There's a weird thing happening, even for myself, where my work is becoming more important than it ever has. And I'm being called upon in new and exciting ways. And that's exciting because it's always lovely to have the labor that you've put in over your lifetime pay off, in the sense of that to be able to serve people with this work feels very, very good. And of course, the irony being, I wish the work wasn't necessary at all.
Right.
You know,
right. Because right.
This idea of that the reason why the work is more popular right now is because people are actually facing their trauma. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that the trauma exists whether we're facing it or not, which is the big thing I'm always trying to educate around. So we can pretend that the trauma doesn't exist, but the trauma is there whether or not we acknowledge it. It just gets either swept under the rug and it becomes any number of things, from mental illness, physical illness, relational illness, financial illness, or we are consciously managing it and navigating it. And so what I think is happening, due to COVID really bringing us all into a very collective experience and a collective trauma, is we can no longer hide from our shadow. It's like literally physically right there, always next to us, you know, especially right now, because we can't escape in the same ways that we once could. And then that's why when all of this happened with George Floyd's murder, that people were even in a space to be able to talk about it, hear it, talk about it, have a conversation about it, is because typically we would have already been so busy with the rest of our lives that we would have just went on with it probably. So I'm excited, if we could say that loosely, about the idea that we're having difficult conversations.
Yeah.
I'm excited at the fact that I have cultivated a whole toolkit of things to support people during this time period, meaning that I feel very affirmed in my life's work right now. It was like, okay, good. You know, because there was a way where, especially when I got my mediation credentials, where I was really like asking my intuitive inner voice, like, really? Like, what? Okay, what now? And what's this about? And I just would hear like, oh, you know, just do it. And now, of course, it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's all making perfect sense. And so I guess those are things I'm excited about. I'm excited about the fact that I've been invited into new spaces like corporations and organizations and communities to teach a lot of trauma education and some conflict management facilitation. So that excites me on the work front, and all balancing that with, to be honest, it's a very heavy time for all of us, including myself. It's not like I don't feel the weight of this just because maybe I have tools in my toolkit on how to navigate it. I have to work a little bit more on inviting in some more joy.
Yeah.
Because it's been such a heavy time, but I do feel hopeful about the fact that these harder conversations will lead to some social and, you know, global changes.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
And then do any resources pop up, that any books or people to follow? Yeah.
I would say that since our conversation has ended up largely centering around the intersection between culture, race, and trauma, that I'd really like to recommend a Minnesota educator, Resma Menakem,
the yes.
author and educator, because he does really phenomenal embodied work around racialized trauma. And I think that he is a great resource. He has a 5-day free course on his website that people can take around racialized trauma. He has a book. He has many interviews, recently 2 interviews on being, one with Robin D'Angelo. So,
yeah.
So people can tune into those things as really, he is definitely somebody that I look to in terms of this integration of both trauma and race. Very important voice on the subject right now.
Yeah, I have the book on my side table. I need to read that. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Susan, for just sharing so much. It's relatable and extremely relevant. And even though I've been feeling inspired, you make me want to do even more. So I thank you for that. And I know that that's going to carry over into the listeners as well. So thank you.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that, Jen. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And that's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed this week's show. And as always, you can find more information at goingtherewithjen.com, including how to sign up for an introductory coaching session and get in on my list of favorite really hard questions for when you're ready to look in the mirror and face your shit. I'll be back again next week. And in the meantime, remember that healing is possible and sharing our stories helps others feel less alone. Until then, bye.